edit the thing.
Right.
I do edit the show lightly.
Okay.
Mostly to make you look better.
Right.
And take out some stupid shit that I say.
No worries, man.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is writer, producer, comedian, and some guy from Flatbush, Brooklyn, Orlando Bishop.
How's it going?
You have your first documentary.
Well, it's a fictional documentary.
It's a fictional
documentary. Yes, it's called Fight Your Way Out.
Yeah, you're going to have fictional documentary.
Yeah.
That's what confused me when I was looking at it.
Yeah, the whole idea is it's sort of in the vein of a 30 for 30, like if you watch on ESPN, and it's about a boxer and his brother, and they're from Flatbush, Brooklyn, and it's a sort of the story of him preparing for this fight. We get to learn about their story and their history up to point. So it's not a comedy itself, but my directorial debut on the future side.
All right, well, we're going to get in on all that in a minute, but first we have to have a message from our corporate overlord.
All right.
Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is writer, comedian, storyteller Orlando Bishop. Thank you. Hello.
How's it going?
Good. So what do you mean it's a fictional documentary?
Well, I had a story idea.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I wrote a 14-page treatment. I showed it to actors and we got together and talked about the story and the characters all together and this boxer and the family and the story of how this family had come together through adoption and some other pieces, and then worked with each of the actors specifically on their pieces. They brought pieces of themselves into each of the characters, and then we interviewed them. We really went in. I was the documentarian, and we went in and interviewed them to tell this story, but in that documentary style. So there were times I asked a question. I wasn't sure what the answer was going to be.
So they're all in character.
They're all in character.
They're all in character the whole time.
Exactly.
But so you shot it like a documentary.
Exactly.
But it's all jive.
So it's been a lot of fun, and worked with some the boxing. So we did in stills, like sports stills. So I've been working with some folks on the graphic piece of there, and so I'm really excited about it. It's different than anything anybody's seen. But as we know about this town, it's also different than anything anybody's seen. So, you know,
it's bad right up until the moment everybody decides it's great.
Right, So hopefully, I'm hoping we get to crest that part, get over that part of the hill.
And you live out here, but have you made stuff in Flatbush before? I mean, you went back there to shoot this?
Well, I did. Well, I actually didn't go back there to shoot. A lot of movie magic to this piece. So there were some photos and things that I was able to get, or some folks took for me there. And then, but the interviews and so on, we were very, very, very vigilant about palm trees and other things that identified LA. Yeah. Yep.
So you could, I mean, they do that all the time, all the establishing shots, you shoot someplace, right? Seinfeld.
I know, entirely out here. So that was pretty much what we did there. I would love to go back to Brooklyn and shoot, though.
Right.
And there's some other ideas I have that I really would love to actually be in the place and show it and some things.
You still got people there? You still go back to Brooklyn?
I do, from time to time. Lots of folks I went to school with. I still have family there, cousins and so on. My sister and nephew have since moved down to Maryland, so I also hit down there a little bit. But, definitely have a lot of people in New York.
And what's happening in Flatbush now? Because I know Brooklyn's out of control. I mean, it's been out of control for
years. It's pretty wild to hear some of the stories. I was back a while back, and I was texting a friend of mine. I grew up in Flatbush, as I said, but I was in Bed-Stuy, and I texted my friend, "I'm having sushi in Bed-Stuy."
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
There's a sentence you never thought you'd ever see.
No.
So it's pretty funny, and some of people joke about it. And the last time I was back, an old friend leaned over to me and said, "Orlando, there's a white family living in your apartment." And so we sort of say, the place has changed a little bit. And that's a lot of the deal with Brooklyn, for better and worse, with all that gentrification stuff.
Yeah.
But there have definitely been some changes since I was around.
Last time I lived there was the late 80s, and I lived in Fort Greene.
Oh,
right,
sure.
Spike Lee neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which was beautiful, but it's a Spike Lee neighborhood,
right?
And now it's like full of French people, and hospital white babies in strollers, and I mean, not even recently, like 10 years.
Oh, yeah, no, it's been a while, and developed and developed and developed that way. So, yeah, it's been wild to see how some of that has played out. I actually joke around about, you know, I went on and married my lawyer wife, and I've got my two kids and my dog, and, you know, that, like, much like Brooklyn, I gentrified my life. So, so sometimes when people are trying to understand my story a little bit,
things
tell them that.
A little bit, I have one more question about that. Why a fight movie? Two boxes. I mean, do you have some connection to that world yourself?
Yeah, it's sort of...
I mean, aside from getting beat up in middle school.
Right.
Beat up in middle school.
I guess it layers to that, you know, sort of the metaphor for me, that's always been a metaphor I've held on to for life. I've even thought of my life. I'm sort of like, okay, if the average person lives 72 years, what round am I in, and how am I doing on the scorecard? Uh-huh. So I've always had that sort of bouncing around for me. But my dad was a big boxing fan, and we shared that. So boxing has always had a place in my heart, even though I know about boxing and the world of boxing. It can be rough and those things, and sometimes, you know, people don't end up with the millions that you would think they'd end up with, but sort of there's a real beauty, as brutal as it is, there's a real beauty to me of just, it's just the two of us now,
right
here we go.
Yeah, there's something about boxing, it's personal.
Yes,
it's really intensely personal. I mean, aside from the punching in the head stuff,
right,
you look in that guy right in the eye from 2 feet away.
No lies in there. You know, they know. You know, I'm convinced that many boxing matches are done as they read the instructions. I mean, I think that at times they just look into each other's eyes and one of them knows, oh no. And so I think the magical nights are when they disagree. Right. When they say, no, I'm the guy.
Hell no.
I'm the guy.
Yeah.
And then you get those great fights.
Now, here's something well, the first thing I was going to tell you, which you probably know, is that you have kind of a Google problem. Because when I Google Orlando Bishop, it sends me to some Catholic church in Florida.
Yeah.
You must know that.
I do know that.
Yeah.
I do know that. I gotta get a lot bigger to beat out the Catholic Church.
Yeah, anyway, as long as you're aware that that's happening, all right. Now, here's something I find curious. You have been a TV writer.
Yes.
You wrote for Seventh Heaven.
Yes.
And you wrote for Secret Life of an American Teenager.
I did.
Now, Seventh Heaven, the characters you wrote for is a white Christian minister and his seven kids.
Right.
And The Secret Life of an American Teenager, the character you really are writing for is a white, pregnant,
teenager.
Suburban teenager.
Right.
You are not any of these things.
No,
like,
not.
You have some connection with these kind of white Christian suburban people?
Right.
Or like, what are you, is it an obsession? Is it like your secret self? What is going on that you are writing about these people?
Well, I actually, you know, in terms of that, I was a part of the writing team for Seventh Heaven, and on my own otherwise, sort of had the opportunity to meet the showrunner, and she took a liking to us and then to me, and we came in and did that. So it's not, it didn't come from that impetus. I think once I got there,
you didn't say, when I grow up,
this is what I'm going to do.
I want to write for pregnant white teens. Yeah.
But yeah, for me, especially the Seventh Heaven piece, I grew up, you know, going to church every Sunday and some of that. So some of those things really did resonate, and there's like a simplicity around the family and that kind of thing that I have liked. It worked for me once I was there. But no, I didn't set out and think, you know, where I'll be magic.
Right.
Writing suburban white people. That's
especially
the
like pregnant teenagers and stuff. And you're like way out of that.
Yeah, no.
So is there some special challenges in that? Or you have to like check like, wow, no, that, yeah, I don't know. What happens then?
Yeah, for me, it was trying to meet them where they were, and then just bringing sort of what's the basic piece. So one night I always remember about Seventh Heaven, it just made me chuckle. It someone else brought up was having them look, the two young sons look at circulars. They were starting to be interested in girls. All of a sudden, you know, they're getting a different feeling looking at these pictures.
Yeah.
And I remember the Sunday paper. I remember being like, "There's a bra." We're getting there. So, you know, I could all of a sudden, these kids who seem, you know, in many ways that's so far away from me, all of a sudden. I try to always find those pieces when we were having the conversations in the room or when I was tasked with writing something. And then, you know, we got to write the very special MLK episode. So that was a little closer to our natural strike zone. And we worked on that. But that was a lot of it, just figuring out. That's still a husband and a wife. Like, there may be some other elements. Yeah. That's still a husband and a wife. So what's that going to play? How's that going
to
play out?
Well, and that's the job. I mean, the job is to speak to who the people are and to connect with them as people, human to human.
Exactly.
Jeff Foxworthy could write for a Tyler Perry show. I mean, it's unlikely to happen.
Right.
But he probably could do that.
I will say, and I guess many people are, but I am hoping moving forward I'll have opportunities to write more and do more that's closer to my story, and I've been really thinking about that because I think there's some pieces I can bring to that. There's a level of detail and attention that I can bring to that maybe isn't there otherwise. And sometimes when I watch things that are supposed to be from where I came from, I go, now no one would say that way.
You got an example?
Well, this was a fun one. They're so wildly successful. Whether they care what I think. But Law and Order, I would always be like, that is just a generic West Indian accent. Where's that person from? That person's not from Trinidad. That person's not from Jamaica.
Right.
Where's that person from? You know? And when you grew up with people, you really know that, like, somebody from Barbados does not sound like somebody from Trinidad. There was stuff like that that I would
react to.
But not, you know, nothing huge comes to mind at the moment.
Okay, so it's not like some secret thing that you have for...
No. It is an interesting, it's an interesting resume.
I had to ask about it. What are you working on right now? We got more stuff to do, but got anything to plug, promote, talk about?
You know, I know it might be early in the game to plug it, but I'm working on doing my one-man show, essentially. Really want it to be that stand-up set. And so I've been hammering away at that and actually started doing the last few years, I guess about 5 years, maybe a little more than that now, really gotten into storytelling and doing the storytelling shows and bringing my stand-up background to the storytelling has been a lot of fun. I think the audiences get a kick out of it because I have a sense of keeping that pace up.
Yeah.
But then I have a little bit of permission. If I can nail, you know, 6-7 good laughs in minute one, they'll give me minute two. They'll give me minute two to tell a little bit more of the story.
Some backstory and fill in some gaps.
You know, and minute three, I'll pick you guys back up,
once
I promise.
Right.
And that's been a lot of fun. So I've been hammering away at that and really wanting to... What I like about it in terms of what I'm working on as opposed to just sort of like set up punchline, is that it's going to give me a chance to talk about some of that growing up in Flatbush and what that was like. And, you know, I've seen, you know, one sort of a story that I'm definitely going to include figuring out how right now is, you know, I watched a guy jump. I was in the library at Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn. And I'm there doing my homework, and there's commotion by the window, and I figure it's, you know, like some guys fighting outside or something, whatever. I'll go take a look, and there's a guy up on the sixth floor across the way and arguing and yelling. I'm 11 years old. Watch the guy jump.
Really?
And, so, you know, I've stood on stage and held a mic and had people laugh about that for however long, and my reaction is, there's something there, and as dark and crazy as that is... Let's go there. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, let's see what's in there. So that's the kind of thing I want to do. I think traffic and dating are pretty well handled at this point.
Probably, especially here in LA.
Exactly.
Oh, and weed jokes.
Yes.
Especially if you're in your 20s, 30s.
Yeah, we yeah.
Should,
so
you yeah. should grow out of them eventually, but
you know. Right. Also, you know, I was told a long time ago that never use the first punchline. And I, you know, a lot of the weed jokes. That's the one everybody's going to think of. And I, you know, I feel like a lot of weed jokes I hear are first punchline type jokes. So, you have that.
Now, I have a controversial question.
Okay.
More controversial than, you know, are you secretly like a pregnant 17-year-old?
Right.
On your site, you know, you mentioned that people say you're a new millennial Bill Cosby.
Yeah. That's old language.
It is old, but it's aside from whatever Bill Cosby stuff.
Right.
Setting that aside, that's still a pretty big thing to say about you or yourself.
Right.
He was a master.
Yes.
Master.
Yes.
You know, when he was coming up, what is it that this is my word, what is it that he was doing that you think you have in common with him, right?
Yes.
Some ability to hit people and tell a story and connect. Yeah.
Absolutely. So there are two key pieces, and it was something that was that came in a conversation. You know, you shape it for the website, as you're aware, but it was something that came through conversation, and there were two key pieces. One being the family element.
Right.
And I cannot tell my story without talking about my wife and without talking about my kids. And I enjoy doing that. And I think it isn't just sort of like, oh, my cutesy family stuff over here and then my real life stuff over here. I mean, some of the, you know, family stuff is that real life stuff when I'm, you know, figuring out how to make my way through Hollywood and I'm reading the same article every year about how racist Hollywood is. It's like, well, guess what? My kids still need to eat. You know, while, you know, I know this is a great article for Variety to get out there, but that doesn't help me feed my kids.
We're going to have to do something about this.
Exactly. Yeah. Until next year, we write the same article. Right. So I feel like that's a piece. And the other piece for me, and it's a natural way that I got to the storytelling, because that piece on the site was written even before I got to the storytelling of it all, was that I've always wanted to be a storyteller. I've always liked that brand of comedy as much as I've enjoyed Hedberg or Stephen Wright, some of these people who just, and I mean that sincerely. I find what they do to be brilliant.
Yeah.
Truly did in the case of Hedberg, obviously. But I always knew that my funny was going to come from, you know, stuff like, you know, we took a trip to Disney and there's, take it through that story and whatever side roads we need to go down and get there. And for me, even listening to himself, you know, Bill Cosby himself, but so all this stuff, but that one in particular, I just found myself going, where does someone get, one, the nerve, and two, the genius to make me laugh for, what is it, 5, 7, 10 minutes about a trip to the dentist? Like, right. What? I mean, that's... That's amazing, and so that's been that's an aspirational piece, I guess, to have that level of storytelling ability. Yeah, yeah.
My first introduction to him, I was probably in middle school, and I grew up in Philadelphia.
Gotcha.
And we were flying out to the West Coast for like a family vacation, you know, and it was the 70s, so all you had was the audio in the airplane.
Sure.
And I put it on, and they had a comedy channel, and I have no idea what other comedians were on that loop. But I listened to that thing like 6 or 7 times.
Wow.
Just so I could keep hearing him tell the same stories, right? The one about Dead Man's Hill and the coming down the thing. Right. With the, you know, there's that whole one.
Right.
I don't even remember what, but I was like, this, I was there. This was amazing, amazing stuff.
Right.
And it's not just that the jokes are good and well-crafted because, you know, I mean, all that. But this is what you get, his personality.
Yes.
With every comedian.
Yes.
Like who they are and their point of view and why they think this is either irritating or funny. That, you know, like could you do his material and get the same stuff out of it? No way.
No. Yeah, no. And it's funny you say about who they are because, you know, again, putting that stuff aside for a second.
Yeah, we don't need to get into the Bill Cosby thing. I mean,
it's been explored. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all there.
We know but I think... For me, it actually led also to who I wanted to become. And that was a big piece for me.
What does that mean?
So, like, through his comedy, but also through the Cosby Show. I mean, that was a game changer for me.
The Cosby Show
was a complete game changer. Changed the way I saw things. Changed who I wanted to be. I tell people, you know, I read Fatherhood, you know, his book Fatherhood, when I was a junior in high school. I don't think, I mean, yes, he was funny and yes, I was great. I don't think I was the target audience and I don't think most guys my age were reading it. But I just, I want to be there. I want to have kids. You know, I want to, when I was watching the show and knew less than I know now, I wanted to have 5 kids. After 2 kids, I was good with 2 kids.
You woke up. But,
exactly.
Damn. That was a fictional TV show.
Exactly. Yeah. They all left after a half hour.
Right.
But yeah, I just, you know, so for me, wanting to be there and be that brand of dad and, you know, I knew my dad, but my parents were divorced, so it was a Saturday thing and just the idea of, you know, I'd be working on my homework and my dad would walk by was, you know, mind-blowing kind of deal. And I said, no, that, like, I want that. So in some ways with the show, he became an amalgam, I guess is the right word, of Bill Cosby and Cliff Huxtable for me over time. I mean, that's
what I think for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think the modeling piece was big. And I think it also makes me aware of, I'll do quote blue stuff. I wouldn't say I'm a blue comic, but I'll have some fun there and what have you. But I'm aware of what I'm putting forth. It's real. I'm not constructing, but I am aware of not wanting to say things that are going to be harmful, hopefully saying some things that are going to be helpful to people when they leave the room.
Right.
And if I would like that to be part of my comedy.
Yeah,
we all laughed, we all had a good time, but if I made you think about something a little differently or approach something a little different, that to me, that would be the true mark of me having done my job well.
Well, then you're using your superpower for good rather than for evil.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
All right, now I want to change something up. I have a question for you.
Okay.
I would like to have a quick conversation about race in America.
Okay.
I mean, we could have a long conversation.
Right.
I'm just curious about, I have here Race in America, : a report card.
Mm.
Like, where are we today? And I'll tell you why. Because now that we got Donald Trump president, last year before, people talk that things are going down.
Yes.
That everything is terrible and, you know, the world is ending.
Right.
And I'm checking in to see if you think that is true.
Right. I think... How are we doing?
Yeah.
At this exact moment, I'd say somewhere in that C plus B minus maybe range. I mean, I don't think, you know, if we're sort of setting our polls here. I mean, I think, you know, when slavery has happened, you know, I can't say F. I mean, I'm here. I drove over here in my car. You know, I was free to do so. So, you know, that kind of thing. But I think right now what's happened is a lot of people have felt silence, pushback, and now there's sort of this, like pushing a basketball underwater. I mean, I think it's just exploded up, and so I'm nervous that grade's going to fall. That's what I'm most nervous about. And I said to a friend of mine when, you know, we're in the run-up to the election, I said, if he's elected, hate crimes are going to go up.
Yeah.
And my friend is white and male and straight and was, you know, telling me that I was essentially being silly. I mean, he may have put it a little more politely than that, but I said, I'm telling you, I know what's behind law and order and make America great again. I mean, I think we're at that B minus going into the C plus, and I'm hoping we don't take that grade down into the D, F area, because it could happen.
You think it could?
I think things could get worse. I think things could get worse from here. Yeah, because I think that I think there's some sense of vindication. I didn't like this vision of America anyway.
This liberal version,
at the airports, let them in.
Right.
Don't let them in.
Right.
Get them out. And so I think for some people, this is, you know,
vindicated.
In the sense that, you know, I'm allowed to say this now. Trump won. You used to tell me I couldn't say this. Now I will. And I think that backlash will also lead to a backlash from the other way. Like, oh no, I'm not heading back there. So,
yeah, in my lifetime, right? I'm 54.
Okay.
You said, oh, I know I'm not supposed to be saying this thing. That has changed. Like, I was born in 1962. There's all kind of crap that you could say in 1962 that by 1992, 1982, you knew this was not the thing to be talking about on the street.
Right.
And so a lot of those people are still alive. They didn't change.
That's
attitudes didn't really change.
I think that's,
it's just that there is a political correctness. And and I'm saying that in a good way.
Right.
You know, I know people say it in a disparaging way.
Right.
So that stuff didn't go completely away.
No.
Right. People die and new people are born and millennials, and that's all good and that's happening.
Right.
Because millennials are the most ethnically mixed up generation that we've ever had.
Sure.
So they, you know, a lot of them can't be throwing stones.
Right.
So
I mean, it's sort of like,
so that's something that I, you know, I'm like, look at the line. I mean, it's just been 50 years. A lot has happened.
Yes, in that's why I wouldn't say F and I wouldn't say sure. I think what you say about millennials, it's true. It's absolutely factually true.
People die and new people come. Yeah.
I think the danger is, I think for a while there was some space in there where people were feeling like, oh, racism is going to die off with the racist people. And you weren't saying that, but I think that's part of the conversation here. And so I think there was this false sense of security that if, you know, we just sort of stumble through time, this will sort itself out. And I think we're learning, it's going to take a little more work than that. It's funny because you mentioned political correctness, and I'm always blown away by the idea that someone, and I know Bill Maher had his show name and all that, but that you would intend to be incorrect. I mean, in what other realm of our lives do we say, you know what, I'm going to get this wrong. I'm going to get this dead wrong. And it's a fascinating piece that people are pushing back. You know, my name's Orlando. I don't want you to call me Bob. No, I'm going to call you Bob. Well, I don't want you to call. What do you mean you're going to call me Bob? And we wouldn't do that in traffic. You know, I don't drive on the left side of the road 100 miles an hour and the cops pull me over. Right. Hey, I'm not traffically correct. I mean, no, you never would do that. Right. And
why is it in this particular area of life that you're allowed to be on the other side?
And that's sort of a thing to pursue. I feel like people, when people say I'm not politically correct, it's like they view it as a badge of honor.
Right.
And I'm like, well, why do you want to get this wrong?
Yeah.
Really, we're just asking you to be respectful. I mean, is that... You
know? No, that's really all it is.
It really is. So you're finding this being respectful thing pretty taxing, huh?
Yeah.
That's
a good point,
actually. Yeah, so at any rate.
Well, what did you... I retweeted you the other day. So, you had something about... no, I know you tweet a lot. I have to remember what it is. But it was a quotation that, you know, power never gives up power.
Right, without a struggle. Yeah, without
like,
a demand. It was Frederick Douglass,
right,
okay. Because in part I did it because of Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Whether power it's based on race or class or, you know, anything, religion,
yes.
Power does not give up power.
No, and so that also for me is sort of this whole thing, you know, snowflakes and the marches make no difference. I'm like, maybe. After 3 weeks, I would say, if anything, I see evidence of the opposite. If anything, I see people taking note of the numbers and taking note of, you know, LAX getting shut down and taking note of it and going, well, maybe we've got to take a step back, do this in a more orderly fashion.
Well, and some people who are kind of like, I'm down with you, but I'm not out on the street, they're inspired.
Yes.
They're inspired.
Yes.
And that's what a movement is about. People,
absolutely.
You know, do the unreasonable thing, and it inspires other people to do the unreasonable thing.
Right.
Right?
Right. And I think also inspires them to do something, right? So you may just not be... It was funny, actually, when I was out at LAX, someone had a sign that said, I hate crowds. It was essentially, I hate crowds, but this is important to me. I'm out here anyway. And I thought, like, that was funny to me. But I think if you hate crowds, make some phone calls. Send some postcards. Nobody has to do everything if everybody does something.
Right.
And I do think that that's something that's coming out in this, that's coming out in all of this. And in that vein, we're doing a show called Democracy... How? And we did our first one inauguration night. We're doing one for 100 days in April. April 29th, actually, at Sal's Comedy Hole.
And is it comedy or storytelling?
It's going to be variety. It's going to be comedy in there. Liquid Feet was with us last time, so a comedy dance troupe and some other things. So, but the whole idea is, again, it's something that we can do. We can raise a little money. Every little bit here, we can raise a little money and help out some organizations that might need a boost over the next few years.
Everybody.
But, you know, to me, if you're, you know, not one to call a senator, but you are one to come out to the show and support, you're doing something.
Yeah. Get some wings, give us some money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
The two other points I had about this, I know you've had things to say about Rachel Dolezal. It was a big moment when she, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of crazy things have happened and we're not talking about her.
Right.
When that whole thing went down, I mean, aside from just being like, wow.
Yeah.
Mind blown.
Yeah.
I said, look, this has got to be good news because this is the first time anybody in America wanted to be black.
Yeah. It was,
nobody said, I want to be black before. Everybody's passing for white.
Yeah.
Nobody ever wanted to pass for black.
It was a fascinating, and I thought it went in a lot of, and I think for that reason, none of us, I mean, we made our jokes and we had our fun, but I think none of us were ready. Right?
We were like, what?
Wait, what? She did what? I mean, I remember first hearing about it and just laughing hysterically. Yeah. And if you ask me right now, well, what was funny about it? I'm not 100%. It was just, whoa. I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know that could be a thing.
I didn't know people wanted to be black. Yeah.
You know, and so what did that mean? And what is blackness and all that? Now, what's interesting to me is I thought, it feels like as the story came out, it was a little bit more of a cynical move and some stuff with the family. And
By her.
What I originally thought was going to be fascinating was, what if there's really a person who we all are really looking at, mm-hmm. who's seriously looking at us going, no, I'm a black person.
Right.
She was doing a thing. But I did wonder, what are we going to say then? And I get that race and gender aren't the same, but part of me says it's awfully hard to say, hey, this person says they are this and we're all going to deal with them as that, and then not address what do we do on the race, culture, background side on the same thing. So,
well, that was her basic point, was
that
she identified as an African-American person.
Right.
For whatever, like her upbringing, her family, how she had her reasons.
However she got there, right.
But that's how she self-identified.
Right. And so what do we really do with that? Jokes aside, what do we really do with it? Now, my instinct is, no way! That's my instinct, honestly. It's like, come on, what does that even mean? But then part of me does say, I can't dictate everyone's identity to them either.
That's right. That's why that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah. You know? So it's an interesting piece. But I think it's funny because I think her choice speaks to, I saw an article recently in this, you know, they interviewed a number of men, but some of the white men who were interviewed were basically saying, like, the worst person to be right now in America is a white man. Like, their argument was essentially like,
this is very current.
Yes. No one cares about us. Everybody else is being taken care of, and we're the bad guys in everybody's story.
I get it. Totally.
How one could land there.
Is feminism, that Black Lives Matter, everything, you know, yeah.
I'm not saying I agree, but I get if you, you know, I can see how you did the math to get there.
Yeah.
But I think her story kind of speaks to that, right? I mean, if on some level she's saying, like, I think I'll get farther in life with what I have if I go over to being a black person. And in some ways, given where she got with the NAACP, given some of the other things that happened in her life, was she wrong?
No.
I can't say she was wrong.
No, she was right.
So what does that mean?
I don't know how much of it was her authentic identity and how much was her saying, I can get farther in this community with what I got.
I think it was more the latter, which makes it a little, well, it makes it far less interesting to me and more of like comedic fodder for me. But I do think that other case could very well be on the way.
But the second case, which is, you know, less interesting, she's right. You know, like, I'm a college educated person, blah, blah, blah. I can get farther in this community than that. I mean, that's the problem. That's what, that's the issue that we're trying to solve for.
Right.
That it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's an interesting piece. And yeah, if, you know, being college educated, you know, I've got a master's. I mean, where that puts me percentile-wise, as I make up words, but where that puts me in terms of my, you know, my race is very different than where it would put any of my classmates from SC Film School, you know, who are white. It just does.
Nobody wants to be white today. Right, you look at pop culture, movies, music, sports. Like, nobody's saying these white people really got it made. You know, I mean,
which is interesting.
Nobody wants to be white. I mean, like in she's got Do the Right Thing.
Right,
you know, he's talking all about that. That was 20 years ago.
But I think what's the interesting piece is, I think the Make America Great Again, and I think is a lot of people saying, oh no, I do want to be white, and I like what white meant, and I want it to mean that again. And right. I think a lot of the pushback against Make America Great Again in calling it racist, was accurate, but I think it was also easily brushed aside. But I think people were hearing, definitely hearing that in there, was I want to get white, male, straight, Christian, recentered, right? And everyone else can figure it out from there. If I'm accustomed to eating alone, giving you half my plate feels a lot like starvation, but it doesn't mean it is starvation. It just means it feels like starvation.
I think these are the same dynamics like you're saying. Black Lives Matter, same thing, right? They didn't say Black Lives Matter more than anybody else.
Right.
They just said, look, right now they matter less. We're trying to bring it up to equal.
Right.
And then other people see it as a zero sum,
right,
and they're going to lose something there. But it also happens, right?
Right.
I mean, you had a big feminist wave, 60s, 70s, 80s, and the response was the men's movement.
Right.
Where men started to say, look, we're not farmers, we're not manufacturers, we're not working with our hands.
Right.
Now we got to be talking about stuff. Women are all empowered. They're making more money than us. We feel like we're lost.
Right.
When you said recentered, regrounded.
Yeah.
The men's movement, again, you could be cynical about it, and a lot of women are, but at its heart, if they had something good, it was men trying to say, well, who are we? As women blossom and in society, like, who the heck am I still? I'm getting lost.
And I think what falls apart sometimes in that conversation is if you say, I'm getting lost, it's your fault, then you get into an adversarial version. Whereas I think there's a new, talking about the men's movement, I think I'd like to see a men's movement that's more about figuring out what it looks like in this world. Yeah. Whereas I think some of the men, what I hear as men's movement or when people talk about fathers' rights sometimes and a few of these things feels a bit like, she's not going to take my money from my check, as opposed to what does parenting look like in 2017?
Yeah, like all these things. If you say that the answer is to go backwards in time, back to the old days.
Exactly.
It just doesn't work because things change.
And and there are reasons why it's not that way anymore.
Yeah, and stuff is not going back in the bottle. Like we were talking before, Make America Great, Trump. You know, people are freaked out, but there's so much stuff about gender, race, all kinds of things, economics, women in the not going back in the bottle.
No.
I don't care what he does.
And they can't. They simply can't. I mean, on another level, I told a friend of mine, I was like, that man told you guys he was going to bring back the industrial age, and you believed him. Now, that's on you. he's not.
I can tell you that.
You can't. So I think that's a big piece. I've been on this idea a lot lately of toxic masculinity. Just I've read about it, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it comedically yet, but I think it's huge. And I think it's one of those foundational ideas. You could probably take me to any societal ill right now, and I'd be able to show you where that's a factor.
Yeah.
So I do think we're trying to figure that out. And what is this going to look like? I mean, the switch from forget race for a second.
Yeah.
Barack Obama and how he was and what his relationship with Michelle was like, who he was as a father, even how he presented, you know, there's a shooting at a school and he's talking about it and he's tearing up and whatever.
Right.
That's a very different version of manhood from, I miss the old days, they would have taken him out on a stretcher. And you know what I mean? And whether you like one or the other, we've got it.
They're totally different.
Those are models of man. And I think a lot of this, and it also then gets into the whole Hillary, where's the sexism in that? But I think a lot of this was, you know, what was really being voted on in November. I think, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of the political issues we discussed because we had to be discussing them theoretically, but I think we were at much more of a lizard brain level in this last election.
I'm going to say yes to that. let's move on,
because
we
could
be talking about for a long time.
Should I be being funny here? I feel like I'm not being very funny, but
feel free. Well, you know, the thing about the race is like, we have to find the funny. It's in my notes. We haven't really found that yet. But here's something that's been messing me up about race recently.
Okay.
When I send an emoji that is like the thumbs up emoji or the smiley face emoji,
right.
Now all of a sudden it gives me six different skin tones to choose.
Right.
Now I am a mixed skin tone. My whole life, people have been saying, what are you?
Right.
My whole life.
Mm.
My mom says, when I was 6 years old, I looked at a baby picture, and I said, Mom, when I was a baby, was I colored? I mean, wow. It was the 60s. That's, sure, you know, sure, that was, sure. Language-wise, that was not an issue.
Yeah.
But still, I didn't know. When I send a thumbs-up emoji or a face emoji, now I don't know what to send, because if I send one to you that is darker than my skin tone, you know, I'm pandering to you, you know, and kind of culturally appropriating. But if I send it lighter, people that are lighter than me, darker than me, what do I send?
Right.
I've thought about it too long.
Right.
That's the thing.
Right. Well, I think that's an interesting piece, because when I first saw those, my reaction was, oh, that's, you know, that's great. What a great, and I hadn't thought about that, but that is funny that.
What color thumbs up do you say?
I don't go to the darkest brown. I probably go one in from the darkest brown if I'm thinking about it. I'm pretty sure.
And that's so kind of your color.
That's pretty close to my color.
And you send the same one to everybody.
To everybody. But I do have a friend who is white, who sends me, now we have the kind of relationship where that's funny between us, but he always sends me like the black fist, the black thumbs up, and we, you know, so that we can laugh about that piece. But I hadn't thought about serious, you know, for someone who's really looking at it going, well, which one of these do I send, and receiving it, right? Well, like, oh yeah, real nice, you know.
So with that friend, he sends you the blackest one, the black fist.
Yeah.
He's a white guy, you're not. And you laugh about it. So
right.
What's the laughter? Like,
right.
Are we laughing?
Why would
about
he choose that?
Yeah. What's the joke between you two?
Yeah. It's a good piece. I guess he's saying, you know, I'm with you, brother, which is kind of like, so if it's funny, does that mean I don't really think he's with me, or is it funny because we're laughing at why he would need to be? I don't. There's a lot in there.
Mess with my head.
Yeah.
And it's emojis.
I like that idea though. Sitting there and trying to choose, like being stuck between, you know, which one do I send?
Especially if you don't know the person
there.
Very well.
Yeah.
Like we just personally met. Although we're trying to get this thing hooked up, and so yeah, with you,
right?
Like, well, what color
do I send?
He's I don't want to be a punk about it, you know?
I love it.
That's been really messing me up. here's a question.
Okay.
How old were you when you first ran away from home?
That's so interesting. I think I was probably around 10 or 11, and my running away from home was as complicated as me declaring I was going to go live with my dad and my mom saying, go ahead, and me immediately knowing what a bad idea that was going to be. So it wasn't, I didn't get all the way, you know, some people get down to the bus station or whatever. I didn't even make it to my front door. As soon as she said, go ahead, I went, yeah, no.
No,
you're supposed to be over here telling me not to leave you.
Yeah.
That's how this was supposed to play out. So, yeah, I guess that was sort of my first lesson around not making threats. But, yeah, that was, I guess that was the first one.
So just like,
yeah.
Like, damn. So she jujitsu'd you.
She got me on that one. I guess in some ways, going away to college, man, I was there and I was fully there. I guess I came back to New York after my freshman year. I came back to New York for less than a month, and my reaction was, I have more fun up in New Haven. And so I spent all my summers up there. I went, you know, obviously I came and saw my mom, whatever, but like, sure. I was gone.
You were gone.
I was gone.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, my buddy actually went to Columbia. You know, two of us kind of came up together and pulled that off. Nobody would have bet on us when we started that he would be at Columbia, I'd be at Yale. Two guys from Flatbush. But yeah, and I remember him, he just went to Columbia, which is a train, you know, a subway
train
ride away.
Yeah.
He might as well have been in Timbuktu, man. He was gone.
Well, that's...
He was gone.
West Side, Upper Manhattan.
Yeah, exactly.
You get to Flatbush as far.
It's way up there.
As a child,
mm-hmm.
you had an imaginary friend.
I actually had a whole team of imaginary friends. I used to, I was a huge baseball fan. I don't keep up with baseball nearly like I used to.
Yeah.
But I was that kid with the baseball cards, and I knew Paul Molitor's batting average to date. I want to just say the Yankees. You guys are just, I love baseball, and I would play out entire games between the first grade classes in my living room. Now that got me in a ton of trouble because I would make foil balls. I would go get my mother's aluminum foil, and I would make foil balls. And then, of course, she'd go to cook something, and there'd be no foil left. Those conversations didn't go that great. Yeah. But I would, I would be there, and I had my little plastic bat, and I'd be up to bat, and then I'd be the pitcher, and then and we'd be pinch hitting, and nine innings of fun. I could take you through a good evening in my living room, and we'd have a good time. So I always. I guess it's funny that with the fictional doc, being a sports thing, I've always tapped into the story behind sports. Sometimes it's a funny story, sometimes it's not such a funny story. But I've always been very interested in who are these guys otherwise?
Yeah.
Like I recently heard a great story about the 86 Mets trashing a plane. Like they just that's it. They had to scrap the plane. Like they were that wild. And I just thought it was the funniest thing. Way more fun than hearing anything else about what happened on the field. I already saw that part.
Did they win the game?
I think they were headed to the World Series, and they got so fired up, they wrecked the plane. And I just thought that's hilarious. So I've always been into that stuff behind it. So in my head, and then there was of course there was the girl. I was never that kid who was like, oh, girls are icky. I was always like, you guys are out of your minds. Girls are great. There was always, the girl and the rivalry over the girl. And, of course, I was always on the winning side in the baseball game. So, I get the girl. Okay. Come on.
Well, here's the rest of this question.
Yeah.
As a child, you had an imaginary friend. You had a whole team of them.
Yeah.
Your imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend.
Okay.
So where are they now?
With my imaginary friend.
Yeah, if your imaginary friend would have had their own imaginary friend.
Right. I like that. That's good.
Obviously, you can't get this wrong.
My imaginary friend's imaginary friend. I think my imaginary friend's imaginary friend would be a blue-collar family man. I think... For a lot of us, even reconnecting with some guys, different people did it different ways or what have you. But I'm struck by how many of my friends are really into being dads. And I think it's something that connects a bunch of us who made a range of decisions, good, bad, just different feels, different. But it links us all back up, man. Like they're doing their best to be great dads, and I'm doing my best to be a great dad, and it looks different for each of us. But we're all trying to, I should say all, but a lot of us are out there doing it. So, I think he'd, maybe he'd be driving a bus. That's a good Brooklyn, Ralph Cramden. There we go. We'll get him in there. Or, something like that. Maybe teaching, which is a little different. And that's about this
King of Queens guy. I saw that.
Yeah.
That kind of character.
Exactly.
Right?
Going in that. Yeah, I think in that direction. A lot of my buddies ended up that way. Other people end up a number of ways. But, a lot of my buddies ended up there.
Now, here's something that maybe has changed for the better. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure in the past there have been good dads.
Right.
But it seems like this generation of has a different awareness.
Yes.
Right? Because women are in the workforce. Right. Where, families, you need to mix it up and share things, whatever.
Right.
The consciousness about, I'm going to be a good dad, this is my job, that seems new and encouraging.
Yes. I agree with you. I think it's great. I think it's great that I know people we really connect on that, as I said, and people aspire toward it. I think it plays into some of this back and forth that happens around who's a beta. And then you'll be online and so-and-so's a cuck, and you kind of, that's an interesting, you guys are taking the world in an interesting direction there. So I think there's pushback against that, but I think that's another one of those things that's not going back in the bottle. I think a lot of us are seeing it, how important it is, what a huge impact it can have. And also, I remember saying to some friends of mine at one point, I said, I think those who skip out miss out. I mean, I think I got a lot. I just get so much from my kids. I think I give a lot, but I think I get a lot, too. And I think a lot of people are going, why were we why were we skipping this? Right. This kid's going to be three one time. Right. And an interesting piece there is my father-in-law, who's, you know, older than me, obviously, and of a different generation. He stressed to me, enjoy it.
Don't miss it.
He was very clear, and we have some great conversations. Yeah. And, you know, people make their in-law jokes, but I've got great in-laws. And he was very clear with me. Don't miss it. Don't skip out. And I took his words to heart, and I'm really, I mean, I wanted that anyway, but it helped me to go, yeah, pay attention. Even sometimes when, you know, they're talking to your girl from the back seat, and every once in a while, I'm like, oh my God. And then I go,
no, it's not all pleasant.
Right.
No, we know that. We got that.
You know, but you go, hey. You
no
know.
Relationship
right.
is all pleasant.
Right.
Not even my relationship with myself. So
yeah, maybe especially.
Well, I'm just saying where you set the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, on your
website, on my end,
yeah. On your website, also you talk about you realize you set the bar low. You have low expectations,
right? Yes.
But I want to just reinforce that is the secret to success is to have low expectations.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that you should do bad,
right.
or do poorly all the time. But there's a lot of stuff that if you lower the bar, it gets more helpful. Like, if you are on a diet, you're trying to stop smoking, and then you fall off the wagon.
Right.
And you can feel really bad.
Right.
But you know what? You just get back on.
Right. As opposed to being in that perfection.
Yeah. So when you lower the bar, it makes it easier to get started. It makes it easier to track progress and celebrate wins.
Yes.
You know, we're always talking about raising the bar and making but sometimes lowering the bar is good.
Well, I think we also raise the bar mid-jump sometimes, which is a problem, right? So, you know, I'm going to be there for my kids. So now you're there for your kids, but you couldn't afford X, Y, Z for your kids. And that's the reason you're a failure or in your marriage or what have you. And I think we, you know, we just move it. So I think part of what you point out is if we can have that bar in a reasonable place, doesn't mean you can't clear it, doesn't mean you can't raise it over time. But, you know, I'm definitely somebody who, like, if today I take my first hike, tomorrow I'm going up Kilimanjaro. It's like, maybe slow down a little later, but, you know, take it easy. But, yeah.
Well, as a parent also, you get to the end of the day, some days, and you're like, nobody died today.
Right. That's a win.
I made it. I made it.
Yeah. No, that's,
nobody's in the hospital.
That's a win.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we, I mean, and, you know, you've got an 11-year-old, too. We had those twins newborn. I mean... Whoa. I mean, seriously, when you got to the end of a day, if everybody was asleep and in a crib, and it was that was definitely a win.
And you said your wife's a lawyer.
Yes.
So she's working, man.
Yes.
She's not hanging around the house, making lunch in the middle of the afternoon.
No. She's doing her deal. Yeah. She's labor and employment attorney. And, you know, obviously a little while thereafter we first had the kids, but then she was back at work and we were figuring it out, you know, from there.
Yeah.
And it's a tricky piece. You know, I made fun of myself some at the time, even on stage, but it really made sense for me to pick up the home slack because her earning potential in that moment was way ahead of where mine was. So we could have played the like, but I'm the man game. But we would have been worse off. So
did you have some feelings about that?
Yeah. It was tough. It wasn't what I had imagined. I know what I thought was going to happen in the business, which, you know, nobody comes to L.A. thinking, you know what, probably 15 years from now, nothing will have come of this. But, yeah, so I think it was tricky at times for me and very frustrating and just sort of figuring out what I was going to do next. And, did everything from SAT tutoring to working in warehouses to just, you know, whatever to get a couple bucks to put together while I was writing scripts and writing jokes and all that kind of stuff. But it was tough. It was, there were definitely some tough moments.
Have these issues like, here's my wife making more money than I do. She's going to work every day.
Yep.
And, you know, people just go to a party even.
Right.
Right. And
it's tough. I mean, you know, I would joke about her being the real grown up and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, and then you hear, you know, the comments others make and jokes in quotes others make and, you know, oh, that's really, you know, that's their house, but it's really her house,
who's wearing
that's
the pants?
Tough. Yeah,
guys in a comedy club, they're always
they're gonna
push
go
your
there.
Button.
Yeah, so it was. Yeah, it took some work. it took some work and some deep breaths. Yeah. Sort of go. All right, this is where we are.
Here's something else.
Mm-hmm.
I like to anagram things.
Okay.
just because, you know, you take the letters of something and you rearrange them and it makes right. another word or phrase, and maybe sometimes the light bulb goes off and you say, wow, that's amazing.
Right. You know? Yeah, you create the story, yeah.
So I tried to anagram your name. Okay. Orlando Bishop.
Right.
I got a few things. I'm going to say we'll take a look at them and just see what comes up. I mean, that's, okay. you know, maybe,
let's see.
Maybe not. Right. So read the first one there.
Shipboard loon.
I don't know if you're a sailor.
I'm not.
Not a sailor.
I'm not. I
loved the phrase shipboard loon for some reason.
Yeah, well, certainly the loon. The loom piece. I don't know where we're headed on this ship, but I like that. It made me laugh. Yeah, shipboard loon. Where would I be headed? I guess that's the question that comes to mind. But the loon part, yeah. There's a lot of that in there.
I think I actually saw in my mind kind of like the albatross from one of those Disney animated things
with the mice.
You know how he's kind of like hits the deck and ba-boom and
goes over or something. I like that.
But again, I hadn't even met you yet, so it wasn't personal.
What I like about it, too, well, I guess if I were going to go in that direction, I think it would be a very neurotic character. Shipboard Loon would be very neurotic. So as he's making his way around, he's bird, he's nervous, there's a lot going on, a lot to process while we, you know, will we make it to the end of the story safely?
So he could be like that second in command, because if you're a bad guy, you definitely have a very inept
Second in command, yes.
Especially in a cartoon.
Exactly. So that'd be much more that character.
All right, so that's one. All right, so, you know, but you get it. This is how we play this game.
Yeah, I like it.
Then this one. Read that one.
Bad Rhino Polos. Is that right?
That's what it says. Orlando Bishop, Bad Rhino Polos. I thought this could be your new clothing line. Bad Rhino Polos.
Yeah, well, it sounded like the tiger for, you know, we got the rhino.
Rhino, the thing, it's always flipped up the collar.
I like it. I like it. You got that old school, like the Run DMC changes. Like it says Rhino on there, so you know what you got there.
Have you thought about a clothing line?
Not in years. I actually did think of one years ago. We were working on a project that was taking us into the hip hop world a bit and looked like it was coming together at the time. So we said, well, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I haven't. I don't know that the world is sitting around waiting to find out what I think is going to look good in the spring. But maybe some other time. If Kanye's line can get traction, then, I mean, I can't be wrong. If that is okay, then I cannot be wrong.
All right, so you can park this bad rhino polos. If you need it, just run with it.
All right.
You don't even have to call me for permission.
I appreciate it because it's
your name.
That's fine.
How about this one?
Bald Iron Hoops. Is that our travel team? I do sports coaching, so I mean we might be on something.
What do you coach?
Flag football. Uh-huh. This year I didn't do basketball, but I was coaching basketball. So I was at my kids' school for a little bit, and I do some coaching for NFL Flag LA.
Okay.
So I started a flag football program at my kids' school.
Yeah.
So maybe that'd be our travel team. Bald Iron Hoops.
Bald Iron Hoops. The image I got here, honestly, was like an East Coast city basketball court in the winter. For years, I got a new basketball every Christmas.
Nice.
Because I wore it out, you know.
Nice.
And that's all we did. We played sports, different sports each season, right? In Philly, you just...
Yep.
And so you get that new basketball Christmas morning.
Right.
Snowy or rainy, you know, you still got to go out there, and the net is gone, right?
Because it's winter. Oh, it's been gone.
It's gone. They're going to put a new one. Somebody put a new one in springtime. But, you know, in November, December, February, there's no... So the bald iron hoop, I just saw a wet, no-net, urban
gray hoop. Sky.
Yeah. You know, and you're out there. Your hands are cold.
I like it.
You know, and you're just trying to...
Yeah.
That's us where
hopefully nobody comes and takes your ball. depending how it's going for you.
That's just what I saw.
Yeah.
But it could be your travel team. And then this last one.
Old Porno Sahib. I need to know more about Sahib. Uh-oh, Chester is unhappy.
So, Old Porno Sahib. You said you need to hear more about the Sahib part?
Yeah, well, I think, this Sahib character, I mean, it's sort of like, I'm seeing sort of this 80s. It was a big deal then. every once in a while somebody stops on the street and starts to recognize them, and then they're like, oh no, I don't know you. they move on because if I know you, that means some other things. So I think, yeah, old Porno Sahib, I see him, you know, he's got his cigarettes going, and maybe he's got his coffee spot where he hangs out.
But, I looked it up just to make sure I understood Sahib accurately, and it is. It's a term of endearment, you know, it means sir. It's originally, I think, Persian language, India and other places. So, yeah, I mean, sir, you're a distinguished person.
There you go.
So what you're getting, yeah, that's what I got, like the old... the guy. I like what you said, though, that you're like, hey, don't I know you? And then you realize where you know him,
and then you can't know him. You can't know him anymore. So there you go.
So we're talking about like Ron Jeremy.
Yes.
That's it.
He used to run with Ron Jeremy. That's right. The whole old gang, man. Yeah. I don't know if this will be, but I was in, when I was in college, you know, as guys will, someone, oh, they've got this crazy porn. So we're like, all right, whatever, you know. But and they put in this film called Amazing Granny Bangers. So the old Porno Sahib also made me think, like, maybe he'd turn up in one of the old Amazing Granny Bangers movies. I remember being about 3 minutes in and going, guys, we go too far. This can't be right. We've got to turn back.
It's not sexy. Mm-mm. Like, there's nothing. No. I mean, there's sex, but it's not.
Yeah, you're like, it's not what, turning me on. What do we do?
But and that's so here's my theory, that there are also like these super like gory, crazy movies that are comedies.
Right.
I think that that's what this is in the porn world, that it is like a horror movie or like a gross-out comedy movie.
Right.
It's not about the sex. It's about the spectacle.
Of we will watch this.
How crazy is this?
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. Because, even in the context of... it's just not what you would expect. But
it's like watching Jackass or, what you know, Marcus his home like, videos. Right, it's not about the...
Because, why would you want to watch somebody just get nailed like that? But there's just something about going, oh, yeah, there it is.
Like we haven't seen it before.
Right.
We weren't sure if it was still there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what does it look like when somebody gets nailed in the head? Amazing Granny Bangers. That's a college memory.
Amazing Granny Bangers. Here's one last anagram. I anagrammed Flatbush Brooklyn, which anagrams to Bob Honks Artfully. And I was curious if people in Flatbush just honk their horns like crazy assholes, or if some of them are,
yes,
careful and artful.
I would say yes, absolutely. And I wouldn't have thought of this naturally, but I'm glad you did, because I think the honking of a horn can communicate all kinds of things. I mean, there's the very like just like, hey man, I'm not here to fight. I'm just letting you know the light turned green. I'm not sure what you got going on up there. There's the lean on it. I mean, yeah, you cut me off. I wasn't really going to hit you, but now I'm just, you know. There's a lot of different directions you can take the honk. There's the, you know, the heads up, the look out, you opened your door. All right, I'm gone now. You know, and you take off. So yeah, there are a lot of honks. It's funny, when I first got to college, it was, and you know, it's New Haven, Connecticut. It's not exactly the sticks, but it was too quiet. You know, I'm coming from Flatbush. You know, there was noise all night from in distance, at the very least, and it was just entirely too quiet. So like a honking horn or something like that was welcome to me. That was like, it was like a lullaby.
That's funny. Bob honks artfully. All right, here's my very last question.
Yeah, sure.
For reasons that will be unexplained at the moment.
Okay.
They don't really matter. I have told a bunch of people, friends and family, that it's always okay to hit me in the face with a pie or a squirt seltzer.
Okay.
So I've, you know, this thing that it's you normally don't have permission to do,
right.
I've given them permission. So you're going to do this. This is the question for you. You're going to give someone permission to hit you in the face with a pie.
Right.
And I'm going to say it can be anyone through history. Living or dead, imaginary, real person. You're going to get hit in the pie, in the face. You're going to get hit in the face with the pie by anyone you want to have throw that pie. And they're going to do it, you know, with love and generosity. You're going to accept it with love and generosity.
Right.
It's not violent. It's not angry.
Yeah, you know, I got you.
Who would you like to throw this pie?
I'm just going to go with the first answer that really came to me, which is Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor.
Because somehow he would elevate the throwing of a pie to something that none of us had contemplated before. It would just be the funniest throwing of a pie, I think, that ever did happen. And then hearing him tell the story of hitting me with the pie would be its own treat. So I think I'd go with Richard Pryor on that one. But I like that question.
I think you're right. He wouldn't just hit you with
it. Right? Don't you sort of know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else? Any other things we need to talk about? Did we cover everything that we wanted?
I think we covered things. I mean, I hope folks will check out Democracy How, and there'll be more from me on the storytelling front. I definitely want to be getting in front of audiences more again, and I'm excited about that. So yeah.
So Democracy How is going to happen at 100 days into the Trump presidency.
Exactly.
So that's like mid March.
April. So it'll be April 29th is the show, the Saturday at Sal's Comedy Hole. Yep.
At Sal's Comedy Hole.
Yep.
And it's a fundraiser for.
The last one we did was for Alexandria House, which is a transitional residence for women and children. We're solidifying. I don't want to say because we're solidifying what this one's going to be. But each time it'll definitely be a cause that we think is going to need a little boost during these times.
Yeah, something worthwhile.
Exactly.
All right. I would like to thank my guest, the very funny and entertaining Orlando Bishop, for coming in this week. If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, that's what it looks like. You can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. So far, no one has emailed me saying that they want a mug.
Gotcha.
Like in months. Nobody's... Anyway. Dylan Vigil is our producer and engineer. Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Mermel. You've been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. Orlando, thank you again.
Thanks for having me. This was fun. I like this.